Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get 10 for $10 on select varieties of Kroger pasta, Starkist tuna pouches, or Powerade with your card. Then get 6-ounce packs of juicy raspberries or blackberries for $1.88 each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're back today with Vit History Maker with Kevin Pham. And today we are going to get into Nguyễn An Ninh. But before we get into him, I want to ask you about your recent trip to Vietnam. How was it?
Thanks, Ken. That's a great question. It was an incredible experience, as always. I always love going back to Vietnam. I've been going quite a lot. So As I think you know, I lived there for 8 months in Nha Trang in 2011, and I've been back about 8 times. And so this time, I led a group of students from the U.S. and other community members through an organization called the Center for International Experiential Learning, CIEL. And so we were there to learn about Vietnam's history and also how a society recovers from war, right? How did they develop after war? So the group of students, they went to Cambodia after, but I stayed back in Saigon. I also gave 2 book talks there. And so one thing I want to talk about, because it's directly relevant to our topic today, is national pride. When I was in Vietnam, especially on January 2nd in the evening, you could feel the national pride surging through the streets because Vietnam beat Thailand in the ASEAN football game, their final championship. And then 3 days later, on January 5th, Vietnam beat Thailand again. And so they became the champions.
Wow.
So it was amazing. I mean, I couldn't walk through the streets. Like there were motorbikes, there were flags, people were having fun. It was amazing.
But can I ask you something?
Yeah.
When we as overseas Vietnamese American kids, when we are experiencing something like that, and we see all those flags of Vietnam, present day Vietnam, which is the recognized flag internationally, how do you think that makes people at home feel? And at home, I mean in the U.S., when we are trying to celebrate the Vietnamese winning something internationally, and we as the diaspora, we see these flags, and what goes through your mind while you're in the sea of red flags?
I would love to know how other Vietnamese Americans feel when they are, do they root for Vietnam when they play? And how do they feel when they see the flag? I would love to know that. For me, I grew up seeing that flag actually in Vietnam because I go there so much, so it doesn't bother me or anything. And I think over time, I've been able to empathize and also feel pride as well. I mean, this leads me to something else I want to talk about, which is, I mean, let's face it. Today, if we look at Vietnam, Vietnam has done a much better job than its neighboring countries and other post-colonial nations in terms of economic growth, in terms of sharing that growth among their population, in terms of how well its citizens can access healthcare, education, infrastructure. Vietnam has done a really good job. The life expectancy on, if you look at just various objective metrics, they're doing really well. And there's the point I'm trying to make is there's much to be proud of, right? And when I grew up, I would sometimes ask myself, do I feel proud being Vietnamese? When I look at Vietnam's performance today, I feel proud, actually. Yeah. And also, I got to say, and this is a very weird thing for me to say because I'm a child of anti-communists, there's a narrative that has been promoted by the Vietnamese Communist Party of Vietnamese history. And the narrative goes something like this, like the Vietnamese people, united by pride, has defeated the Chinese, the French, the Japanese, the Americans from their land. I think of, there once was a taxi driver, I read this in a book, but the taxi driver turned around to the American and said, do you realize that we are the only country in the world that has defeated three of the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council? So he's referring to China, France, and the United States, right? Like that fills the Vietnamese in Vietnam with pride today. And I can't help but sometimes feel it also, even though I know that the narrative that I just outlined, the kicking out the big powers, that's in many ways a myth. And I could get into why it's a myth because, you know, 1,000 years of Chinese rule, were you resisting the Chinese the entire time? Of course not. You were adopting Chinese philosophy, Chinese social, cultural philosophy, methods of governance. You were not resisting the entire time, right? But when we look back in history, yeah.
Yeah, but and there's also this other idea of, were we fully Vietnamese in our identity formed in those 1,000 years yet? Or were we just provinces fighting off other provinces of China, of southern China, right? There's all of these debates about that idea. And I think this idea of 1,000 years of fighting back is almost a recent theory or a recent battle cry of the last 200 years, perhaps, to kind of like to congeal, to coagulate, to bring and reinforce Vietnamese people as a national identity force, to say, hey, now it's us against them, which is the Chinese. But in actuality, the evolution of culture and people of the South, Yunnan, is something that is the nuance is very, very rarely talked about. So I just wanted to bring that up, and I'd love to hear it in the comments today.
Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams. Your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up. We record it and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
Absolutely, Ken. I mean, this is a nation-building project, creating a story in retrospect.
Yes.
Saying that there was always a unified Vietnamese people, when in reality, of course, there wasn't. There were civil wars all throughout Vietnamese history. And even when we talk about fighting the French, we have to remember that the First Indochina War between 1945 and 1954, yes, that was, in a sense, between Ho Chi Minh's Viet Minh, led by the communists, and including non-communists fighting against the French. But at the same time, it also devolved into a civil war in the South, where you had some groups defecting on the French side, right? Towards the French side. So, of course, I mean, I don't want to get really into it, but that narrative of the Vietnamese people united together, defeating foreign powers, there's truth to it, but also it's misleading. But the point that I wanted to make was that hearing that narrative over and over again, it makes Vietnamese people in Vietnam feel pride, national pride, and that washes on to me too sometimes. You know, I can't help it.
But I'll tell you what's super ironic. I hear people in America, Vietnamese Americans, saying, "We are badass because we kicked everybody out."
Oh, really?
Really?
I hear it all the time now. I hear it all the time. Like, we're the only ones who kicked everybody out. I'm like, well, there's a lot of controversy to saying that here in America. I mean, what do you mean we? So are you saying that your family is from the Communist Party that kicked Americans out too? I mean,
this is my point, you know, that there's much to feel proud of. And that was the intention of this narrative promoted by the Vietnamese Communist Party. Now, the reason why I bring up this topic of national pride today is because in this episode, we're going to talk about national shame. And national shame was something that was prevalent in the 1920s. So we're going to go to the 1920s, and we're going to talk about a really, really important figure, Nguyen An Ninh. And he's so important. In fact, he is the one Vietnamese historical figure that I think I identify the most with personally.
Me too. Now that I've
I want to know why. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me too. I'm like this little. I'm older than you, but I feel like a little brother when I'm saying me too, me too, me too. I think you and I, we share this common trait of feeling immense shame, and I think I was blown away reading and researching about Nguyen An Ninh and realizing that my entire generation of Vietnamese American men and older felt this intellectual inferiority, this cultural inferiority that exists inside of me. And I don't know at your generation if you feel that way, but I feel shame. And it's like, oh my God, wait, they were feeling this in the 1920s? This guy was feeling this and writing about it in the 20s, in the 1920s. And here I am 100 years later talking about this has not really repaired itself yet in a lot of men like me. We just have not felt it. And I'm sure other women and men of my generation feel this inferiority complex being brought on from our parents. So I really feel what he in the 1920s of not having something to really be proud about.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, we will talk about this. So let's set up the context of the 1920s, the mood in the air, especially if you're a young 20-something-year-old Vietnamese person. You are part of a new generation. You're 20 years old, 1920s. Your parents, your fathers, your father had devoted his life to studying Confucian classics with the aim of going into the civil service. So your father was trying to do well on the exams to serve the Vietnamese emperor. Meanwhile, the French had finished their conquest over all of your country by the end of the 19th century. And so now you're asking yourself, what should I do with my life? Should I study the Confucian classics just like my father? And what's the point? Clearly, the French are dominating the country. Clearly, they are the ones in power. The natives, our fathers, don't have any power. And so it is this mood, this environment, where a lot of young Vietnamese people are going to begin to say, we need to change Vietnamese society. This whole Confucian classics and civil service exams thing, this whole thing about the Vietnamese having an emperor, that all needs to change. We need new ideals. We need our ideals. So there's a great book written by Huệ Tam Tài. She was a professor at Harvard. The book is called Radicalism and the Origins of the Vietnamese Revolution. And the star of that book, the protagonist, is Nguyen An Ninh. That's how I learned about Nguyen An Ninh. And look at the title of the book, Nguyen An Ninh. He's the star, and the title is The Origins of the Vietnamese Revolution. It is this is what the roots of the revolution are. It's this radicalism. So when I say the word radicalism, what I mean, what Huệ Tam Tài means, is it's a kind of iconoclasm. So when you're being iconoclastic, you're destroying tradition, essentially. You're destroying what your parents had held sacred. So you are being a rebel. You're a young person. You want to cast off the shackles of tradition. It's a rebellious period in Vietnam. It's in response to colonialism, but it's also in response to the oppressiveness of their family, of their environment, of their own culture. So the youth in this period, they're growing alienated from the French and from their own parents, who they see as accommodationist elites. Again, the colonial authorities are not giving the natives any real power. So the youth are becoming skeptical towards all authority, including their parents. They're becoming attracted to anarchism and to the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. I don't know if you've read Nietzsche, but Nietzsche is famous for you need to struggle against traditional morality. You need to craft your own identity. And so I thought here would be a good moment to show viewers my own rebellious side.
I was going to stop you right now. I was going to stop you and say, okay, we need to talk about you in your rebellious stage, because I've heard from dear friends, mutual friends of ours, Quingo mainly, that you were a huge punk rock. You had a totally different image than how you look today. You had a mohawk, you wore leather studded jackets, you had green hair. You were a rebel in your early days. But let me ask you this. You didn't even know that Wing Hang Ninh existed at that point in your life, did you?
Not at all. I didn't know anything about Vietnam or Vietnamese history.
This is why you have such a deep connection with this Vietnamese icon.
Yeah, I mean, so I got this jacket, this professor-looking jacket tailored in Vietnam, right? But back in the day, I used to dress like this.
Yeah, if people can't see, if you're listening to the audio podcast, it's, you know, Kevin in the gold chain with a leather jacket.
It's not gold. It's not gold.
What is it? It's silver? I mean, it's a button.
It's a silver chain, and it's connected between the studs that I have in my ears with my lip ring. And I wore this jacket with studs all over. So I was a punk rocker, and I still am, but I just don't dress that way. And here I am with a green mohawk.
That's crazy. Shaved heads, shaved sides.
But and there's something important here, though. This is educative. Why did I feel the need to dress like this when I was younger? And I have to admit, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I wasn't following any trends here. Nobody else in my high school dressed like this. Nobody else did. I did.
Why
you were going to say something. Why
did you have the need? And then I also want to know what your parents reacted. How did they treat you? And did they have a talk with you?
I think the simple answer I can give is punk rock music. Punk rock music changed my life. It's fast, it's loud, it's rebellious. It pushes you to think for yourself and to question authority, all forms of authority. And I loved it. It energized me. And this actually gave me energy to be a good student, actually, because I never, ever, in all of my classes, simply accepted what the teacher told me. If I felt that something was off, I would question it in front of everybody. So punk rock made me outspoken, and I expressed this in my classes, but also in how I dressed. And so it was a spirit, it was an ethos of questioning authority, essentially. And so that's why I think I'm so attracted to Nguyen An Ninh, because this is him. He's 23 years old when he's giving speeches in Vietnam. So, okay, I still need to do the whole bio of Nguyen An Ninh, but I think this was good to show those pictures of me as a young rebel. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do want to talk a little bit more about you right now, if you would give me that space. We will get right back to the bio about Nguyen An Ninh. Well, how did your mom and dad feel?
Oh my God.
Yeah, my other question too is, do you think Vietnam will ever tolerate a punk rock scene? because the music on the surface is the music on the surface. But if we're thinking about the government and we think about the intertwining of the punk rock ethos, you would say maybe that is not a good movement to allow youth in Vietnam to kind of pursue, right?
Yeah, great questions. I'll start with the first one. When I got my first Mohawk, my parents were not happy at all. So my room, it was covered every inch of the ceilings and the ceiling and the walls were covered with pages from Thrasher Skateboard magazine. And when I got my Mohawk, my mom like tore it all down. She was not happy at all. She was very upset. So was my father. And I think I got the Mohawk because I was going through a breakup. So I was already like, you know, screw everything. But today, you know, they're very happy with how I turned out. My hair combed to the side and all that. But they were upset. But I continued to do it anyway. I was a young rebel.
But they had to
now to all
right?
Yeah, I had good grades. I was a good student. And I think maybe they thought it was just a phase or something.
And did you ever take
to go back?
Did you ever take the time to explain to them what the ethos that you were thinking, what you were going through?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I knew that they didn't like the music that I listened to because it didn't sound like music to them. But I could build, however, a small community of friends, of young people, and we were all punk rockers together. And it was something really special.
Yeah.
It was really amazing because we would go to punk shows all the time. And in those mosh pits, they might look dangerous because you're crashing into people like a ragdoll. But the moment you fall down, you're going to get picked up right away. And I could tell how safe a punk rock scene could be depending on the lyrics of the band that was playing.
Wow.
So we would listen to very, very anarchist bands who were very all about community, about helping each other, very anti-capitalist, very collectivist, all about helping each other. And so those were just very progressive bands. And the people there were just great, you know. Anything such as racism or sexism, it was not tolerated at all. Like if you expressed anything racist, you would get beaten up, I think.
They were wokeness.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a safe space. But okay, to go to your question about Vietnam, you remind me of what happened in Indonesia a few years ago. Actually, I think it's quite a long time by now, but there were a group of punk rockers who had Mohawks, and government authorities shaved all their heads off, shaved their hair off, their Mohawks off, and they forced them to change. I think listeners would have to look into that episode of Indonesian history. But actually, Ken, today there are punk rock scenes in Vietnam. There are punk rock concerts in Vietnam. I don't know much about it. I want to know more about it. I don't know the content of their lyrics. I don't know the message of these bands, but the style of music for sure I know exists there. And the moshing, the crowd surfing, the diving, that all exists there. I've seen it happen, but I don't know the content of the music.
I would love to, if anybody's listening, I would love to interview any punk rockers or any punk rock bands in Vietnam. I'd love to talk about that that existence.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get back to the bio.
Okay, back to the bio. Now, I was talking about this very important moment in the 1920s where young Vietnamese are questioning authority, colonial authority, their parents' authority, their own tradition. The most influential figure of this period is simply Nguyen An Ninh. He's going to urge the youth to struggle mentally against their own family, against their environment, against the colonial system. They need freedom from everything that constrains them, be it colonialism or tradition. Now, listeners might recall our episode on Phan Chu Trinh, and Nguyen An Ninh is a good contrast to Phan Chu Trinh. If you remember, Phan Chu Trinh argued that Vietnam was weak. Vietnam was weak because it forgot its Confucian roots. The solution for Phan Chu Trinh was to revive Vietnam by bringing in European ideas of democracy and liberalism, and this would rejuvenate Confucianism in Vietnam. However, for Nguyen An Ninh, the true source of national shame was their reliance on foreign ideas in the first place and their inability to construct their own intellectual tradition. Phan Chu Trinh and Nguyen An Ninh spent a lot of time in France, even together. So when Nguyen An Ninh traveled to France to study law, he met with Phan Chu Trinh and Ho Chi Minh and two other Vietnamese colleagues who are lesser known. Their names are Phan Van Trung and Nguyen Thế Trinh. And they hung out in an apartment in Paris where they debated Western ideas that they had been soaking in and debating how they should use these ideas to assert Vietnamese national dignity. And together the men were called the Five Dragons.
Les Cinq Dragons.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you know about them. Yeah. So in 1923, Nguyen An Ninh is going to return to Vietnam and he's going to give a very famous speech telling the young generation what to do. He's going to shame them for their poor intellectual output compared to other nations. And he wants them to become what he calls great men. He wants them to become artists, poets, painters, musicians, scientists. So at this point, let me give a really quick bio of Nguyen An Ninh. Let me just go through his life's events here. Nguyen An Ninh was born in 1900 in Saigon. He was raised in a family that was engaged in anti-colonial activity. So his father was translating Chinese historical novels and also managed a Vietnamese language newspaper that spread anti-colonial ideas. And his uncle and his aunt were also active in anti-colonial politics. So this is the environment that Nguyen An Ninh grows up in. His father had Nguyen An Ninh educated entirely in French language schools. So Nguyen An Ninh always felt more comfortable in French than Vietnamese. He wrote most of his essays in French. He admitted that he was more comfortable in French. After graduating from high school in Saigon, Ninh worked for a newspaper, and then he went to Hanoi on a scholarship where he studied medicine briefly, but then he switched to study law. In 1920, Nguyen An Ninh asked his father if he could go to France, and his father agreed and sold some land in order to fund Nguyen An Ninh's trip. And according to legend, his father asked his son to never forget his duty to his country. And so Nguyen An Ninh then goes to France and he attends a school in France. He eventually enrolls in the Sorbonne to study law. And in Paris, as I had mentioned, he joins Phan Chu Trinh, Ho Chi Minh, and other Vietnamese expats who were—
Can I stop you right here?
Yeah.
Huge deal. For a Vietnamese person to get to Paris or get to France and to become a lawyer at the Sorbonne, it's a huge deal. I mean, this is, you know, you're not just going to some community college. You're going to like arguably one of the best schools in France. So you have to kind of have a mind that's pretty brilliant to make it into a university at that level. Am I right?
He is brilliant. He's brilliant. You know, I remember I was in Paris reading his journal, La Cloche Follet. I can read French. My French is pretty good. My wife is French. We speak French. And I was just blown away that this young man is 23 years old and he's writing like this. And at the time I was 27.
Wow.
It was hard to imagine, but here he is. He's a journalist. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself here. So in Paris, he's with other Vietnamese expats. And on his bookshelf could be found works by Nietzsche, Rousseau, Plato, Kant, Tolstoy. There was also a photograph of Rabindranath Tagore. This is really important to say here because the point I'm trying to make is that in contrast to Phan Chu Trinh, in contrast to Phan Boi Châu, Nguyễn An Ninh is the first thinker in our series who is really well-versed in European ideas. He reads these European thinkers. He knows their ideas far better than those older generations of Vietnamese did. Okay, so after receiving his law degree, Nguyễn An Ninh travels to Belgium, to Austria, to Germany, to Italy. He travels, and he returns to Vietnam in 1922. He marries the daughter of a wealthy landowner, and then he leaves her and goes back to France to try to obtain a doctorate. Like, he really wants to keep on getting educated in France, but he didn't have the necessary funds. And so he's in France. So instead, he works for newspapers. He becomes a proofreader and editor. And eventually, he runs out of money. And so he returns to Vietnam, you know, and his wife is asking him to come back also. So he comes back in 1923, and upon his return, he gives that famous speech that I had mentioned. It's called Aspirations of the Annamite Youth. So the Vietnamese were called the Annamites. And he creates a newspaper called La Cloche Filée, the Broken Bell. He divorces his wife. He remarries in 1924, and he goes back to France again in 1925, where he translates Rousseau's Social Contract into Vietnamese. And then he leaves France again in the company of Phan Chu Trinh, and he goes to Vietnam, back to Vietnam in 1925. Now, if readers might remember, we did an episode on Phan Boi Châu. In 1925, Phan Boi Châu was on trial, and I think this is interesting. Nguyễn An Ninh said about Phan Boi Châu, he said, "The only crime Phan Boi Châu can be accused of is to have loved his country too well." So he admired Phan Boi Châu very much. So in 1926, Nguyễn An Ninh is arrested by colonial authorities for his anti-colonial activity. He's imprisoned, and then he's released in the beginning of 1928, so 2 years later. And this becomes interesting. So after he's released from prison in 1928, he, how should I say, becomes interested in religion. So especially the Cao Dai sect. So the Cao Dai is religion that professes to incorporate elements of Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Christianity. So Nguyễn An Ninh did not join the Cao Dai, but he was interested in it. He shaved his head, he became vegetarian, and he spoke constantly of Gandhi and Tagore. And I have more to say about Tagore because I've been reading Tagore lately because I want to understand Ninh more. So by the way, listeners, my book has a chapter on Nguyễn An Ninh, and it's called Nguyễn An Ninh's Tagorean Call. So the whole point that I'm trying to make there is that he's essentially telling the Vietnamese people, you need to be like Rabindranath Tagore. I'll say more about what that means. Anyway, meanwhile, Nguyễn An Ninh is developing followers throughout Vietnam who create their own mutual aid organization called the Nguyễn An Ninh Secret Society. So this becomes known to the French police in 1928, and it's unclear how involved Nguyễn An Ninh himself knew about it. His followers probably just made it without him. But anyway, he was arrested again in 1928. He served 3 years in prison, was released in 1931, and then he would be arrested again in 1936, and then again in 1937, and for the last time in 1939. I've lost track of how many times he's been arrested, at least 5 times. And then he's going to be detained in Côn Đảo prison. This is where Phan Chu Trinh was imprisoned. And there he dies in 1943. So there you go. I think there's a lot to gather from this bio, which is, number one, he's arrested all the time from the French, which gives you a sense, a clear sense that he's very anti-colonial, okay? This is a young man who is a problem for the French.
You know, could he have done this differently? As people who are living in 2025, when we think back on this young man, did you have to go to jail that many times? Could you have done this differently, man?
This is a good question. And here's how I would answer it. Nguyen Anh did try differently. And the way he did so was by writing. He was a journalist. As I had mentioned, in 1923, he creates this journal. It's really interesting when you look at this journal, actually, because the subtitle of La Cloche Fêlée was the propagator of French civilization and French ideals. So when you pick up this paper, it almost looks like a pro-French paper. Oh, here's this young man, this Vietnamese man, trying to teach the Vietnamese people about French ideas, but he was very subversive.
Yeah.
So he would print the every single article of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen in this journal. And this was a way of him saying, hey, French people, we agree with your ideals for humanity, but you are being hypocrites.
Yeah. You're just going to say the irony of all of the information and knowledge you pick up in the country of France, and you bring it back to like unshackle your own people. Sure.
Yeah, so he loves a certain France. He loves the Republican, rights-loving France, but he hates the hypocritical, colonizing, oppressive France, right? So to close off the bio, by the way, I think it's interesting to say that pretty recently, in 1980, the Vietnamese state confers upon Nguyen Anh Ninh the title of revolutionary martyr. So today in Vietnam, major streets and schools are named after Nguyen Anh Ninh, okay? Okay, so now what I want to talk about is the core of his ideas. What was his message to young Vietnamese? What was he saying? And what do you and I think about this, Ken? So before I launch into what I think, I mean, you said that you were reading about Ninh. What do you think Ninh's core ideas were?
I feel like he really understood ideas from the Enlightenment or from the European thinkers. And he was saying to everybody in Vietnam, wake up, learn more, understand the different ideas that are coming from a more advanced country. So you can arm yourself with information that you can govern yourself free from, I don't know, a departure from Confucian or monarchic practices. That's how I felt. Like let's break away from the traditions of Confucianism and king and being ruled by kings.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Exactly. He was promoting this ethos of curiosity and open-mindedness among the Vietnamese. Now, remember I had said that there's a mood that we might call radicalism, this mood of rebellion. And this is arguably a bit different from the social Darwinism that had come before. So social Darwinism is going to say that nations must compete against each other. They must survive, okay? The Vietnamese were conquered by the French because they were weak, and if they want to survive, they need to strengthen themselves. Now, radicalism, Nguyen Anh Ninh's radicalism, is not going to depart totally from that, but it's going to say something a little different. It's going to say, look, we're not concerned only with survival and competition. Rather, we are concerned with freedom and the relationship between the individual and society. So at this point in time, many young Vietnamese, they think that there's a kind of symmetry between national struggle for independence from colonialism and the individual struggle for their own independence from their parents, right? the dead weight of tradition, their own native social institutions. It's like they're not only being oppressed by the French here, they feel oppressed by their own parents and Confucianism. So in order to dignify the nation, young Vietnamese believe that they first had to dignify their individual selves by breaking free from tradition and their family. Now, who's going to criticize Nguyen An Ninh for this? Obviously, it's going to be the Confucian elites, right? And there are a lot of them. But what is Nguyen An Ninh going to say about the Confucian elites? He's going to say, and there's this great quote, I'm going to pull it up here. He says, okay, I can't find it, but I remember it. Okay, here we go. I found it. He says, haven't the so-called elite in Vietnam, fashioned by Chinese books, been forced to cling to Confucian ideas like shipwrecked people to a raft? So look at that imagery. He's saying basically that they're pathetic. They're clinging on to Confucian ideas like shipwrecked people cling on to a raft. The solution, he thinks, is to let go of the raft and to swim for yourself. Learn how to swim for yourself. You need to learn how to swim. And he's saying this because he thinks that the Vietnamese people have pathetically been parroting Confucian and Chinese ideas. They don't even know what Confucianism is. So if you look closely at his writings, he does not badmouth Confucius. He actually thinks Confucius had smart things to say. All he's saying is that the Vietnamese don't even really know what Confucianism is. They just think it's a philosopher, so they repeat it. And even worse, that's the only Chinese philosopher they know. He says the Vietnamese can't even name any other Chinese philosophers. So then Nguyen An Ninh goes on to name others. So he says, you don't even know who Lao Tzu is. How many of us can read Lao Tzu? And there's irony here because Confucius himself recognized the superiority of Lao Tzu over Confucius. So Nguyen An Ninh is going to say, isn't this, I'm quoting now, an obvious sign of the weakness of our race, the mark of the helplessness of the finest minds back home. So the Vietnamese are praising someone, Confucius, who himself believed he was inferior to Lao Tzu. And I think it's important that he brings up Lao Tzu. Have you heard of Lao Tzu,
Ken? Of course. I was just going to say, when you brought up other Chinese philosophers, I was thinking of Lao Tzu. But when I'm listening to all of this, I'm thinking to myself, I always thought to myself, there was such a weird difference between being Vietnamese and all other sort of Southeast Asian
ethnicity
world. And now I'm beginning to understand maybe that break, that line of demarcation that separates the Vietnamese is because Nguyen An Ninh, because he introduced this idea of like, well, there's this idea of curiosity. And I don't think he fully was able to integrate this idea of curiosity. Otherwise, we'd be in a totally different place in Vietnamese society. But there's this, like, when we think about, like, French influence in our culture, this man really brought it. He really brought it into my father. My father told me growing up, he always reminded me. He said when he was 17, he'd read, because his older brothers were all doctors and big guys in the military, and they were always top of their class wherever they went. And they actually went to, excuse me.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good, all 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live. Must start and file in app by 2/18.
I think Wang went to a high school or a school, La Santa Bert, which is, I think my father went to, I think it was a chain of schools, Taber schools. And I remember my father said, all of his brothers went to Taber. He went to Taber. And my father at 17 said to me, I tried to escape in a French merchant ocean liner that carried goods outside of the country. He tried to slip into the compartment of luggages so he can leave the country, because he also believed, like Wing Anin, that the country was not sophisticated enough for him. So that left that indelible mark in my brain that the Vietnamese were, that I live with the shame that my father felt. And I think my father somehow understood Wing Anin, and he always said that we, the Vietnamese, entire country is primitive. We don't have this kind of understand. We're not reading. We're not enlightened like the European sort of bloc. And so this is what I lived through.
That, thanks for sharing this. I mean, I think this is so important, because this emotion of shame, I think there are different ways to react towards it. One is to want to hide, to run away. But for Nin, he is going to exhort the Vietnamese to change. He's going to say, don't run away. You need to change yourself. So I bring up Lao Tzu. He brings up Lao Tzu because he's going to say, one of Lao Tzu's disciples, Zhuang Tzu, the famous Zhuang Tzu, will challenge Confucius's narrow morality and hindering ideas. So Zhuang Tzu is famous for his anarchism and his skepticism, the idea that no one can know the truth. And so they shouldn't just blindly follow Confucius, because Confucius is going to say, follow the way, but the way depends on one's perspective. So I think it's interesting that Nin brings up Zhuang Tzu and this sort of skepticism. Okay, so Nin is going to say, the main problem confronting the youth is that they don't know on where to base their morality. If they turn to China, they don't even have a good grasp of Chinese ideas, because all they know is Confucius. They don't know all these other ideas. If they turn to the West, all the Vietnamese have been doing is simply copying the slogans of the French Revolution, liberty, égalité, fraternity, right? But he says, I'm going to quote him, he says, the future that we desire will not come to us in a dream. It's not enough to mark in gold letters on the front of public buildings, liberty, equality, fraternity, in order for liberty, equality, and fraternity to reign among us. You claim from others things that they cannot give you, things that you must acquire by yourself. So you have to acquire liberty yourself. You have to fight for it. You have to know what it is for it to have any meaning of you. So he goes on to say, look, every people, every race of people needs a culture, and you cannot survive without a culture. So he says, take, for example, the Chinese culture, which we are still influenced by. China has been assailed by barbarian neighbors throughout its history, but it still exists today because of its culture. Any nation with a weak culture has a weak soul, and it's going to be vulnerable to foreign domination, he thinks. Now, the sad, unfortunate thing about Vietnam, and this is where I'm going to read, I think, the most important quote by Nguyen An Ninh. He's going to say, it's a pretty harsh one. He says, quote, if we Vietnamese pile up all that we've produced in our country in terms of purely literary and artistic achievements, the intellectual lot that was left to us by our ancestors would certainly be weak compared to the heritages of other peoples. The literary lot that was transmitted to us is thin, and what's more, it exhales a strong breath of decadence, of sickness, the taste of an impending agony. This is not the kind of heritage that will help give us more vigor and life to our race in the fight for a place in the world. What do you think of that, Ken?
I feel sad that I wasn't exposed to Wynn and in my teenage years. Had I been exposed to his writing as a kid, I think my the shaping of my thinking would have been much more powerful, much more loving and compassionate towards the Vietnamese people. Now I look back on the shaping of our history and our identity with a lot more empathy and love, and deeper love for our people.
Why, Ken? Why do you think Nin would have done that for you?
Because what he espouses, what he talks about is, okay, well, you got to roll up your sleeves and you got to do the work. And that's what we are doing now is we are rolling up our sleeves. We are doing the work that needs to be done to understand and to broaden the understanding of, I think, our people are all around the world. I don't think it's limited to Vietnam in country, but I think the diaspora needs to understand the history of Vietnam. And, you know, I mean, let's just admit to the sort of the primitiveness of where we were before Wing. And then, you know, before the French educated elite members of society came back from France or went to France, you know, what did we really know? We were falling in line with the monarchs and the kings and the ruler that kept the people down. So we were not privy to all these thoughts that were developing in the West. And I think that there's ways to look at it today with a lot of compassion and empathy and understanding that we don't look down on ourselves and we can move forward with just new ideas and accepting curiosity as the baseline for living.
Right. Yeah, that's really well put. So just to once again echo what Nin was saying here, he's comparing Vietnam to other nations. He says, I'm going to quote him again, "Today, when India and Japan are producing thinkers and artists whose talent and genius shine forth as brightly as those of Europe, Vietnam is but an infant that does not yet even have the notion or power to grope toward a better destiny and genuine deliverance." He's going to close by saying the current generation needs new ideals, their ideals, a new activity, their activity, new passions, their passions. To put it very briefly, he wants them to become great artists, philosophers who think for themselves. And he wants to know, can the Vietnamese think for themselves? We need to wait for these people, and we need to want them to come. Now, at this point, I want to slowly shift gears and talk more about what he really wanted the Vietnamese to do. Like, this sounds good, right? But it also sounds kind of vague. What does it mean to become a great thinker? So here's what he would say. He would say, in these times, all Asian minds must be nourished by two cultures, one Occidental and one Oriental. So he paints a picture of like a vampire. The Vietnamese should be like vampires, sucking up the blood of wisdom and knowledge wherever you can find it in order to reinvigorate the life of the nation. So you talk about curiosity, Ken. Here's a great quote for you by Nin. He says, "What we need is curiosity under all its forms, a curiosity that is the last hope and last sign of life, that is capable of every audacity in order to quench its thirst, a curiosity that burrows, seeks, searches, and dissects everything that is life in others so as to find the remedy which will give new vigor to a weakened blood."
You know, I'm going to make this statement. And I think that this has a lot to do with the way there's two education systems. I'm generalizing. The West and the East. The East is based on powerful rote memory. Like, you memorize everything. You go in and you study and you jabai. You return the homework through pure memorization. In the West, we are forced to think about curiosity and innovation. And we don't care so much about this rote memorization in the West. And I think both sides have their strengths and their powers. And I think, but when you leave out this idea of innovation and curiosity and asking questions and getting to, you know, we call it rabbit going into rabbit holes here in America, where we encourage learners to ask questions that have no answers sometimes. And that is okay, because that is how we learn. And I think in the East, this idea of the power of memorization is limited. And I think if we can somehow change the way that Vietnam thinks about their education journey and ask more questions. And I want to actually bring up a point, because you just went through this. Fulbright University is supposed to be the place that challenges academic freedom. Did you experience academic freedom while you were there briefly? And I know you know Yen teaches at Fulbright, but do you feel like there is an introduction to academic freedom and free thought?
Okay. There's a lot to unpack from what you just said, and I want to answer your questions, so you might have to remind me if I forget to. But first off, Ken, first, I see what you're saying. You briefly described what you might call a Western versus an Eastern approach to education, that the West is promoting critical thinking and questioning while the East is focused on memorizing. Now, I actually don't think that Nin would really agree so much with your description or your characterization of the East. Now, certainly, that is what Eastern education had become for Nin, but that is actually not the essence of the East. The essence of the East is a kind of wisdom, he thinks, that it has nothing to do with rote memorization, but it's actually the wisdom of Confucius, of Lao Tzu, of Chuang Tzu. And the only people who had created this rote memory thing for the East are actually monarchs who abuse their power and make it sound like Confucius only cares about memorizing, when really Confucius cared about self-cultivation and good moral virtues such as care and benevolence, and actually critical thinking too. Like, there's a tradition in Confucianism of remonstrance, that you have to critically criticize your leader so that they can become better. This process of self-criticism is a very Confucian thing. So what I'm trying to say is that for Nin and for other Vietnamese who were talking about we need to marry East and West, I think they had a more sympathetic view to the East than you here, Ken. So that's just one point that I wanted to make.
I'm glad you cleared that up. I'm really, really glad that you cleared that, because I've always felt that way. And I think that talking to certain family members who are in the academic field in Vietnam, they also feel that way. But I'm glad that you brought, I'm going to have to think more about that. And thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about this in our episode about Pham Quyên, because Nguyen An Ninh talks about needing to learn from East and West. Well, Pham Quyên is going to talk about that a lot more, and he has a lot more to say about that. So your question about Fulbright, when I gave my book talk there, I really did honestly feel that I was encouraged to say whatever I wanted. Wow. Mm-hmm. I had a friend there. He's a member, an official member of the Communist Party, and he told me, I want you to feel totally free to say what you want to say. Don't hold back at all. Like, he emphasized it.
Wow.
When I was speaking to the Fulbright community, okay, the event was for the Fulbright community of students. So.
Wait, I am mind blown by this. He said to you, no holds barred, just say whatever you think.
He went out of his way to emphasize it a few times. because, I mean, okay, I'll reveal something here. When I gave a book talk in Hanoi, I had sent the organizer my slides and everything looked good. But the day before the event, the organizer reached out to me and said, hey, can you take out the quote of Ho Chi Minh that you have in that slide? So that was my first instance of quote-unquote censorship. So I took out the quote because, you know, I want to talk about my book. And the irony here is that during the presentation, somebody in the audience was like, well, do you have a quote by Ho Chi Minh that supports your point? So the quote was this. The quote was, I was showing quotes by figures from my book who were shaming their people. And the quote by Ho Chi Minh essentially said, so Ho Chi Minh was writing a letter to a young Vietnamese man in 1925, and Ho Chi Minh was exasperated. He was a bit annoyed by this young man because the young man is saying, we Vietnamese need to have a revolution. Why aren't we doing anything? So Ho Chi Minh writes back and he says, why are our people so stupid? How come we cannot organize and mobilize and create political parties? You compare the Vietnamese to the Egyptians and to the Indians who are resisting British colonialism, but our Vietnamese people can't even do it. Where are our parties and organizations? And he calls the Vietnamese stupid. So the organizer wanted me to take out that quote. And so when I responded in person to the person in the audience, I did not say the word stupid because that's pretty harsh, you know? So I said, why are our people inadequate?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
You know, I have a question for you, Kevin. Eventually, we're going to have to address the elephant in the room. We are going to have to talk about Ho Chi Minh.
Right.
We're going to have to dedicate a whole episode on Ho Chi Minh. And here's what I would like the audience to think about, because I think about this. I think when we think of Ai Quốc, which is the love of country, which is actually the name of Ho Chi Minh before he got to Ho Chi Minh. Ai Quốc is the love of country. We know this man loved the country. You know how much the love of country really changed the world of Vietnam? Right? We know that. We understand that. But will we ever be able to dissect what happens sort of after he becomes a little bit more kind of like he peaks and he, you know, all these other generals and these military men take over. And this is where the life of Vietnam changes, is after he hands the baton over. I mean, we have to be able to talk about it. And I say this because we're going to be talking about Pham Quyen next. And I just want the audience to know and be prepared that we are going to go down this route. We will go down this route. And then we're not only going to stop, we're not just going to stop at Ho Chi Minh, but I think we need to talk about, you know, Madam Nhu. We need to talk about President Thieu. We need to go into all of these people, Cao Quỳ, you know, Nguyễn Cao Quỳ, the vice president of the Second Republic of Vietnam. These things are all important for all of us to understand the landscape of Vietnam. I just had to let that out.
This is good. I mean, now you're making me want to talk about Ho Chi Minh, but this episode is not about Ho Chi Minh. We will eventually get there, and I think it's important that we do. Now, okay, one thing that I do want to say, because I want to hit a few points when we talk about Ninh, is Tagore. Have you heard of Tagore?
I've heard of Tagore, but I've never read. Will be my assigned reading. You know, in between these episodes that we do, I do a lot of reading. I don't want to be a student who comes into class unprepared. I want to know things that you are talking about so I can like do a dance with you, you know? So
yeah.
Start reading. Cool.
I mean, I did not know much about Tagore at all until I read Ninh, and he constantly is talking about Tagore. So I started reading Tagore. And as I learn more about Tagore, I'm like, I understand Ninh more. Tagore is a fascinating figure, man, like really fascinating. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913. He traveled all around North America, all around Japan, all around China, all around Europe. And he traveled because he was curious. He's unlike other Indian figures who traveled for political purposes. He genuinely would travel just because he wanted to learn more. And when people would try to interview him about his work, they were surprised because he would always ask them questions. He was like, no, tell me about your culture and this place. And one thing that struck me about Tagore is his fierce anti-nationalism. He was an anti-nationalist. He had a love for humanity, and he thought that nationalism, this patriotism, was making people narrow-minded. They only care about people around them. Well, what if you end up hating people within your nation after you beat the enemies? Like, he thought that nationalism was a dangerous route. And when I thought of Nguyen An Ninh, I think it's tempting to think of Nguyen An Ninh as a patriot, as a nationalist. But if you look closely, he's actually wanting the Vietnamese to become great writers and poets and artists. And by great, what he meant was they need to inspire the world. That's what they should aim at. That's the measurement for greatness. How much do you inspire people outside of Vietnam in addition to in Vietnam? So in a way, that's also why I like Ninh, because I also see myself as a cosmopolitan, right? I like traveling. I like connecting with other people. And I think that nationalism was very powerful for an anti-colonial struggle. But in Ninh, in Tagore, we also see the possibilities of an anti-colonial, anti-nationalist movement. So I think that's interesting. And by the way, I'll just quickly mention, you had said that Nguyen Ai Quoc means, well, Nguyen the Patriot. And there used to be this debate, is Ho Chi Minh a nationalist more than he is a communist? Or is he a communist more than he is a nationalist? I think that debate has been resolved, and I guess this is a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And I won't say more there, but listen to our episode on that. But anyway, going back to Ninh, he is somewhat of a patriot, but he also wanted the Vietnamese to think beyond the nation and to think of, to be greater than the nation, actually, to think in more universalist terms.
This idea of nationalism and this idea of weaponizing nationalism, or when do we use nationalism? When is it appropriate to take it out and utilize it to kind of bring the nation together? You know, it's tricky because I think in America we deal with this wave in and out, make America great again. You know, these ideas of coming together to fight against or even just to be great. Right? I think it's a tricky thing. And I think about the debate of calling my podcast The Vietnamese because, you know, I, on some level, I don't like to use, I'm proud to be Vietnamese. I don't say that. I say, I love being Vietnamese. I love the culture. I love the history, but I'm not proud to be Vietnamese because I can be proud of eating pupusas from El Salvador. I can be proud of, you know, my Angeleno roots, you know, but I love the Vietnamese culture.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up because it lets me talk about why I think Ninh is so important and significant for those who study things like national identity. Typically, national identity is assumed to require pride. Like if you say the term nationalism, that's synonymous with national pride. Nationalism. But national identity is a little different. But people think of that requires pride. If you talk about national shame in the West, what comes to mind? Typically, it's the bad things that a nation has done to others. So if you talk about national shame for Americans, it's what Americans did to Africans. It's slavery. It's the genocide of the Native Americans. For Germans, national shame is the Holocaust, etc. And if you talk about national responsibility, it's simply the righting of the wrongs of those things. So national responsibility for Americans is, compensating for slavery somehow or the genocide of Native Americans. National responsibility for Germans is remembering the Holocaust, making sure it never happens again. But why is this? I'm going to say that the West thinks about national identity, national shame, national responsibility in these terms because they're assuming powerful nations. But if you look from the perspective of the Vietnamese, national identity is not about pride. It actually comes from shame. The shame of parroting the Chinese all the time and not having your own intellectual tradition. And national shame for them means something different. It's not bad stuff, doing bad stuff to others, but it's the shame of lacking an indigenous intellectual tradition. And national responsibility, therefore, means something else. It means recreating yourself anew, So these concepts look very different from the perspective of a colonized nation like Vietnam. This is why I think this Nin is so important for Western scholars who study national identity. Go ahead.
Are going to lead us down the discussion about Pham Quyen in our next episode. Can you give us a little bit more context about Pham Quyen as he relates to, is there any connective tissue with him and Nin?
Yeah. So this is interesting. So I'm going to get to Pham Quyen really quick, but one more thing that I want to say about Nin that answers your question is Nin and Quyen are very different from each other in this one respect. Nin is going to say that the Vietnamese people have not created anything great in terms of literature. But Pham Quyen is going to say, no, the Vietnamese have amazing literature. Look at The Tale of Kiều by Nguyễn Du. Nguyễn An Ninh is interesting here because when post-colonial theorists in the West talk about colonialism, they talk about how colonialism destroys an original indigenous culture. But Nguyễn An Ninh is going to say, yeah, actually, we don't have an indigenous original culture to begin with. So in a sense, it sounds like he's agreeing with the colonizers, but really he's not because he's very anti-colonial. So that's what makes him interesting here. But to transition to Pham Quyen here, they're both writing around the same time. Pham Quyen is going to publicly criticize Nguyễn An Ninh. Pham Quyen is going to point to Nguyễn An Ninh and say, you guys, young Vietnamese, it's going to be a disaster if you follow this young man, Nguyễn An Ninh. He really says that. Why? Because look at Nguyễn An Ninh. Ninh admits himself that he's confused with his own identity. He shaved his head to become a monk. He's interested in the Cao Dai religion now. Like, here's a man who wants to lead a generation of young Vietnamese, but he's having an identity crisis himself. Nin is telling you to let go of the Confucian raft and swim on your own. Well, I'm telling you that you're going to drown. You need a raft. You need Confucianism to hang on. So I think that's a good segue to Pham Quyen here.
I can't wait to get into this. We're peeling back these layers of identity that somebody like me, I'm pushing 50 here soon, that should have, I feel like we should have gotten this information in my teenage years. But
stay with it.
Better now than never, right? Better late than never. And I think that as the years go on, my appreciation and love for the Vietnamese culture and the people is getting more and more richer as a result of learning more about the people, of the thinkers.
Same here, Ken. Well said.
Thank you for today. It is always such a pleasure for me.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good, all 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live, must start and file in app by 2/18.